Good morning, everybody. So first of all, I really would like to thank the organizers of this conference and also the whole Exoplanet program to putting this together. I think it's been really fantastic. I got the privilege to spend the first 3 weeks with them in this program here in Santa Barbara, and I think it's really fantastic bringing together these two communities. You know, people have been studying the formation of the Earth and the terrestrial planets in a lot of detail, you know, through geochemistry and geophysics. And then, you know, the astrophysics community that is used to studying things at much larger distances, having much fewer detailed information on the systems, but often larger statistical samples. And I think it's really great trying to bridge this gap and trying to see, you know, how we can complement each other to really make progress in this field. So I think I really would like to thank the organizers for putting this conference and this program together. I think it's been really great. So in that spirit, I thought I'd like to talk to you a little bit about whether, you know, we can think about the simple ideas that we have about terrestrial planet formation and in general planet formation in our solar system, you know, whether this is a blueprint, whether this could be a blueprint for the formation of close-in super-Earths, and here I call them mini-Neptunes, but I think by now you know what we're talking about, or whether we really, whether there's something really different about them. So here's my super simple cartoon version of planet formation. So I would like to give you this overview, just that you have like a general idea of what we usually be talking about. This is not there are many details that I'm leaving out. It's just like the contour version of what we think happens. So initially, you have the star collapsing in the center of a cloud of gas and dust. And because of the axis angular momentum, you start to form a disk around that central star. That consists of gas and dust, you start forming planetesimals. And so then these planetesimals start to grow and coagulate into bigger and bigger objects. And there's a lot of really beautiful work that has been done on this area of growth, but I really don't have time here to go into the details. So for the purpose of this talk, all we really have to know is that in this picture, you can then calculate the largest mass that you can grow to just by setting down a disk with planetesimals. Then you can calculate how big of a body can you grow to just by it locally accreting all the material that's available to itself. And that's a very simple calculation that you can do. All of you can do it at home. Simply what you have to do is you add up all the material in each of these planets' feeding zones. And so we call this an isolation mass. So if you calculate this isolation mass, right, it's just 2 pi, the same major axis, times the width of the zone. So what determines the width of this feeding zone? If the velocities are really low in the disks, so they all have Keplerian velocities, but in addition, planetesimals and protoplanets will have random velocities that express themselves with eccentricities and inclinations. If these are small, then this isolation mass is just given by the feeding zone that's determined by the shear of the disk. And that's roughly the Hill radius. So if knowing this, you then can calculate what we call an isolation mass. And if you do that in the outer solar system, assuming a disk mass in solids, that's what we generally refer to as the minimum mass of the nebula, or a few times the minimum mass of the nebula. It's like the minimum disk you need to form the solar system. That's all you really need to know for this talk. Then you find isolation masses that are comparable to Uranus and Neptune. And so we can maybe to first order think of the formation of Uranus and Neptune as bodies that formed as isolation masses. They locally accreted all the material in their feeding zones. However, if we repeat this at 1 AU or in the inner solar system, the isolation mass you find is much less. It's only the mass of Mars. So whereas Mars may very well be an isolation mass, one of those planetary embryos, this is only a tenth or even less than that than the mass of the Earth at 1 AU. So although we think that far out planets like Neptune, maybe isolation masses, if you found something like the Earth or something bigger than the Earth, you need to have another stage of assembly. And this is one of the reasons why in the inner regions for the terrestrial planets, we now think they have undergone this phase of giant impacts. And this led to the assembly of a dozen or so giant impacts for the Earth and Venus to their current masses. And then there is actually an additional stage in this formation process, which is the cleanup of the leftover planetesimals. And it's important because at the end of giant impacts, as we heard actually in Sean's talk, you expect quite significant eccentricities because you had to have orbit crossing in the first place for those mergers to happen. And so you're typically left with a system that has eccentricities quite a bit bigger than the fairly circular orbits that we have in our solar system today for the terrestrial planets. And basically, damping by the leftover planetesimals can give you eccentricities that are consistent with observations today. And it's really nice because there is actually evidence that the Earth really did accrete some of those planetesimals late, and that comes from the highly solidified elements, and it's generally termed as this late veneer. So this late veneer may be the actual observation of these leftover planetesimals that damped the eccentricities to the observed values as they were being accreted and consumed in the inner solar system. So the question is, can we think of the formation of all these planets that Kepler has given us, can we think of the formation as kind of a super version of the Earth, my super Earth, or like a mini version of Neptune, or is it some hybrid process altogether? So this is the two end members I want to start out with, and then we can make things more complicated. So the very first question I would like to ask is, how much materials would you need to make it happen? What would you need to do it? So now you can do a very simple thing. Just using this concept of the isolation mass, so the first question is, could there really be isolation masses? If they're formed in situ, could they have just sit there and locally accreted all the material in their feeding zone? So then you can take actually the Kepler candidates. You can relate. So we know how to calculate the isolation mass. We know the width of the feeding zones. So we can actually back out the surface density in solids that you would need it on the disk to form those planets. And that's exactly what we have done here. And this is what you get. So on the y-axis, you have the disk surface density in solids as a function of some major axis. This is instantaneous disk surface density. It's not normalized to 1 AU or anything, just at this location in the disk that you would need to form the planet, because the planet can only eat up the material in its feeding zone. And so what we find is that you need extremely high disk surface density. They are so high that if you use the solid surface densities and then calculate the gas disk densities that you would expect using a general cosmic abundance that the gas is about 100 times more abundant than the dust, you find disks that are so massive that they would be gravitationally unstable. And that's shown here by this line here. This Kumar Q parameter measures, gives you the ratio of the thermal pressure support and rotational pressure support in the disk divided by the gravitational force. So basically, once gravity wins over, once Q falls below 1, the disk would be gravitationally unstable. And so these disks would be so massive that they wouldn't be stable. So it's very unlikely this is how these planets form. So we shouldn't think of them as isolation mass bodies that formed in situ from a disk. So then you think, OK, no problem. We will assemble them with giant impacts, right? So maybe they're formed similar to our terrestrial planets that underwent a stage of giant impacts. And even for that, we can actually calculate what I will now call a giant impact mass. We can actually calculate what the mass would be if you assemble a planet with giant impacts, and again, back out the disk masses you would need. So the first thing we need to know to do this is a little bit about viscous steering. So maybe some of you already know, or hopefully all of you will know, that viscous steering actually tends to increase the random velocities of bodies in a Keplerian disk with time. So the kinetic energy is actually not conserved. So it seems a little bit counterintuitive, because it seems like you're creating energy out of nowhere, because you're increasing the random velocities. What is happening is that this kinetic energy is taken from the Keplerian shear. So you can think of this process very similar to a fluid, a viscous fluid that's undergoing shear, where it's converting free energy associated with the shear through viscosity into thermal heat. This is the analogy. And so based on what happens then, if you start up with a disk, set up with many planetary embryos, and you just watch them evolve in time, they start to excite each other's velocity dispersion. But this viscous steering is not unlimited. So how far will they grow? How far will the velocity dispersions grow? They will grow until the random velocities, this velocity dispersion, is comparable or is very close to the escape velocity of the bodies themselves that are doing the steering. And the reason for that is very simple. Initially, when the velocity dispersion is low, the cross-section for steering is much bigger than for a collision because you don't have to come very close to really double the velocity. Once the velocity dispersion has grown to the escape velocity, from then onwards, you're more likely to collide. The cross-section for a collision is actually bigger than that for having a deflection that would double yourself in velocity again. So the cross-section for it was just much more likely to have a collision and a merger than to double your velocity again. So that limits to how big of a velocity you can grow. And that limit is really set by the escape velocities of the bodies you have in the disk. So now we can calculate what I will now call the giant impact mass. Very similar to the isolation mass, you just equate the disk you have, and the only thing that changes is the width. It's now given, instead of by the hill radius, essentially by the distance that can be covered due to the escape velocity. So it's really the escape velocity divided by the capillary frequency. So if you do that, this is what you get. The key thing is that, again, we can relate the planet mass to the mass surface density in the disk. And I did a few toy cases that it really works. So this is one example from Chambers in 2001. This is a result of many n-body simulations that he did. So I took the same disk surface density profile, and I just calculated the system that I would get from that. And you can see it's very similar. Here I actually gave it an y-axis where I put the planet masses, but the sizes are proportional to that. So that's what's kind of encoded here in the sizes. So this way you can understand why in these simulations you end up with three or four planets rather than just one growing, accreting all the material in the disk. You really get the separation, and they're separated by essentially twice the escape velocity, so an escape velocity on each side. This is the separation you will get, and the mass is just determined by adding up all the mass in that feeding zone. So it's the analytic way of doing n-body simulations. And there's some variety, of course. And essentially, I think you can understand that even by where you start in the disk, where your first large embryo grows, you can pick, you know, where do I calculate my first one? And then I know how far I have to get over in terms of my feeding zone to calculate the next one. I do want to emphasize that this does not tell you that there's no radial mixing. You can pass a lot of planetesimals from one feeding zone to the other. It's just that this determines how much of the total material you get to grab onto. Okay, this is I want to make sure that, because there are these beautiful simulations that show kind of the overall radial mixing. So you can get more radial mixing, but how big you can grow to is really just limited by what you can grab in the disk locally. So with this in mind, I can now take the Kepler planets and I can calculate the disk masses. So this is the same plot as I showed you before. This is, again, the solid disk surface density that I would need to form those planets in situ, where you see them today, as a function of some major axis. And now it's looking much better. I'm sorry, I should have said explicitly. So the blue points here are all Kepler candidates that have already less than 5 Earth radii, and the light blue points are all Kepler candidates that have radii bigger than 5 Earth radii. And I made this distinction because things bigger than 5 Earth radii, there probably is a substantial fraction of gases. You have to be a little bit more careful how you convert from the mass, from the radius to a mass. So there, you know, so the. And again, here I'm showing you the comparison with the gravitational stability limit. So now it's better in the sense that if you assume 100% planet formation efficiency, so that means that all the solids end up in your planets, there's no loss. Everything goes into your planet, then most of the smaller systems are below this instability line. If you have a somewhat lower planet formation efficiency, it's still tricky, especially close in within one AU. So if only 20% of all your solids would end up in planets, you're in trouble. Another way to understand this plot is actually to look at the width of your accretion region as a function of some major axis. And you'll see that it turns up very quickly, very strongly as you go close in. And it's because the accretion, your feeding zone, with giant impacts even, gets smaller and smaller the closer you come to the star. And it's because if you have a given mass planet, your escape velocity stays the same. But of course, the Keplerian frequency or the Keplerian velocity increases as you go closer, so closer to the star. So it's much harder and gets harder and harder to get a noticeable eccentricity out of the self-excitation that can reach out significantly further to accrete material. And this is what's shown here. So the reason, so I will show you on the next slide, that the disk masses that you infer from this is for the typical, for the average planet at 0.1 AU is about 20 or 25 times the minimum mass solar nebula. And the reason why this number is a factor of several higher, factor of 5 higher than this minimum, this extra minimum mass solar nebula that has been proposed by Chang and Laughlin, is because this feeding zone is only 0.2. It's a fifth of 1 AU. And they assume that it's an AU. So you can understand why you need that extra increase, because your feeding zone isn't of the order of the major axis. It gets actually smaller and smaller the closer you go to the star. So this is the comparison I promised you. So what I'm showing you here is the local disk surface density normalized, if you wish, by the by what you would get if you extrapolated the minimum mass solar nebula times some factor. And so this factor tells you the enhancement. So I told you at 0.1 AU, you need a typical enhancement about 20. But it, you know, for some of these planets, it's up to 100. So it's very, very different from our from the disk mass that you would need to form our own solar system. In addition, what this plot shows you is that I've drawn a line here. So actually, so first of all, these green points here correspond to Earth, Venus, and Mercury for comparison. So you, as expected, Earth and Venus fall on this one Earth line at one enhancement, right? So that's kind of by design. So it all makes sense. But I like this plot because these lines here show you how much enhancement you would need to form a given mass planet as a function of some major axis. So I think it nicely demonstrates that forming a 5-Earth mass planet, or even a 10-Earth mass planet, is not very difficult in terms of disk masses if you form them at a few AU. You don't need any enhancement above the minimum solar nebula. There's enough material. It's no problem at all. And so I think, for me, that really demonstrates that you don't actually need to enhance the disk masses very much. You have two choices. I think the planets that we see here, their building blocks, their material, almost certainly came from further away. So you have two choices. You can either move in the planetesimals, the solids, when they were small, to the inner disk, and then assemble them in situ, or the final assembly of the planets in situ, or you can form your planets further away and migrate them inwards. And then you don't need to appeal to any extreme enhancements of disk masses and so on and so forth. Another really strong evidence I think we have is that these inferred disk masses cannot be representative of the whole disk. But if you would take these values and then calculate what disk masses this would imply for the whole disk out to 50 AU or so, is that you find typical disk masses that are 10% of the star's mass, or even comparable to the stellar mass. And we know from astronomical observations that typical disk masses are more like 1%. So you know, I think it's yet another reason why that really strongly suggests that this material probably did not come from there. It probably was delivered from further away in the disk. And these systems are so common now that we can no longer argue that there are some extreme end members that only, you know, we know that 30% of stars have a planet like this already. So this is really, I think, in tension with the standard disk observations. So these are my take-home points for this part. So radial drift and or migration, I think, must have played a key role in the origin of these close-end planets. And there are several reasons why I think that. So first of all, I think disk stability gives us one point. So I don't think they can have formed as isolation masses. There's an option to form them as giant impacts, but as I will show, even then you really, I think, want to drift in the material and then assemble them with giant impacts. Global disk masses are really too massive if you would take those local values and extrapolate them to calculate a global disk mass. Sean has done some work showing that also you would get, if you take the multiple planet systems and would do some radial density profiles from those, that would is not really consistent with disk profiles that you would expect. And also, Kevin Schaufman actually has shown that if you take those increased disk mass surface density in the inner disk, and if you believe that the chance of forming a giant planet really scales with the mass of materials you have, the solids, then you would also overpredict the number of giant planets further out, given what we know about the metallicity relationships between giant planet occurrence rate from radial velocity surveys. So formation of closed-end with giant impacts is a possibility. You do need massive inner disks, typically a few tenths of the minimum mass of a nebula. And we'll talk, and this has been suggested a long time ago already. Sean has done some simulations in 2008, and there's some more recent work on it by Hansen and Murray. The minimum mass solar nebula type disks are fully consistent with the formation and subsequent inward migration or radial drift of these systems that we see. So you wouldn't have to, they don't need more massive disks as long as you're open to the possibility of drift and or migration. And I think what it really tells us is that when we think about planet formation, we try to understand these systems, we do really need to think about what the effect of radial drift and migration would be on these systems. And it may even be that these growth times in the inner disk may actually be determined by the rate at which the material is delivered there. Because we heard that the growth time scales are very fast, but maybe they will not be as fast. Because it may just be determined by how quickly you would deliver those solids there. So that was my first part. That's for just bringing in the material. I'm not even assembling my planets yet. I'm just telling you how much you would need to do it. So the second part is about the composition and structure. So as we heard already many times this week, many of these planets, about roughly half, very hand-wavy half of the Kepler population, require significant hydrogen and helium envelopes. And so these are planets that typically have radii between 2 and 4 Earth radii, and their envelope fractions are, this corresponds to roughly between 1 and 10% in hydrogen helium. And it depends, of course, a little bit on the planet mass. So that's the thing to remember. This already is very different to compare to the terrestrial planets that we have in our own solar system, right? For reference, the atmosphere of Venus is about 10 to the minus 4 of its mass. The atmosphere of the Earth today is only 10 to the minus 6 of its total mass. So these are extremely different type of atmospheres. And whereas the terrestrial planets' atmospheres almost certainly were not accreted from a primordial disk, and you can easily explain them with outgassing, it's not so clear that this would be true for these kind of atmospheres. So we then ask ourselves the question, could you explain these types of planetary atmospheres if you would assemble those planets close to where you see them today with giant impacts? Would you be left with something that's between 1 and 10%, or a little bit more, depending on what you need? That's the question that we were trying to answer. So then what actually and my graduate student, Niraj Ananda, did, he calculated the isolation masses that you would need. So what will happen is just exactly how for the terrestrial planets and their formation, so you'll form the isolation masses, and then you assemble them with a phase of giant impacts. So self-consistently, just I walked you through how this is done. Given the current planets, we can calculate how much mass you would need in the nebula to form them, and then from then you can calculate what the isolation masses would be. So he did this calculation. He finds that the typical isolation masses at 0.1 AU are a little bit less than the mass of the Earth, but there's, of course, a big spread. Then he calculated for each of those isolation masses how much envelope they would accrete. If they sit in the full gas disk, how much atmosphere can they hold onto? And this and is a very nice calculation because this one does not depend a lot on exactly what you assume, because the disk temperatures are so high and the opacities are so high and these core masses are so low that your atmospheres that you have at this stage are almost exactly adiabatic. So this is what's shown here. So let's focus just on the 0.1 AU line here. This gives you, there are actually three lines, and you can't even distinguish the difference between all of them. He did an adiabatic model. One with a full radiative convective envelope structure, where you assume a large accretion luminosity, one that would delay the formation until kind of close to the end before the disk goes away, and one that One way you assume there's essentially no luminosity from accretion itself, and you get the answer you get is very similar. And this is just because the envelope is adiabatic all the way, and the disk masses are so small that there's not a lot of mass in this envelope. Then, with this knowledge, he then calculated how much atmospheric mass loss you have due to giant impacts. And the thin atmosphere model is absolutely beautiful because you can actually do this analytically. And this has been realized a long time ago. So it's like a shock calculation where you have a shock accelerating in a thin atmosphere. And essentially, you can do it with self-similar solutions, and it has been done a long, long time ago for supernova explosions. So that part was absolutely beautiful. However, for these thicker atmospheres, you do have to do it numerically. And so he then calculated as a function of ground velocity, and then he related that back to the impact velocity, how much atmospheric mass loss you get, dependent on how massive your atmosphere is. And as expected, it gets harder as the atmospheres get more massive. But not, you know, crazily so. He then assembled his planets with giant impacts. And this is what he got. So every single one of these little dots corresponds to a Kepler system observed today. Every single point is corresponds to a Kepler candidate. And so it's a function of the core mass. And then on the y-axis, you have the total mass in the atmosphere divided by the core mass. So the typical atmospheric mass that he finds that's left over at the end of giant impacts is only 10 to the minus 3, so 0.1%. And I think this number is very robust. There's a huge spread, but the typical atmospheres that you find are very small, and that's in part because the initial atmospheres are created by the isolation masses themselves are already small. They are already less than 1%. They're like a few times 10 to the minus 3. So there's a big spread in how much you lose because it depends in detail on the impact history. It's better actually to have a smaller number of big impacts than a very large number of smaller impacts. And so he did Monte Carlo simulations to get a better idea of the spread. But the upshot is that it's the typical thing you would expect is planets that have atmospheres that are about 0.1% of their mass. So that's good news if you want to explain the mostly rocky planets that we've heard of, especially on Monday, right? So if you don't have to worry about explaining and understanding why something has needs an atmosphere, if you can fully fit their masses and radii by just something with a solid core, I think that would probably fit this bill. So forming those is not a problem. However, since we know that roughly half or so do have hydrogen helium envelopes or require some light envelope of, you know, a few percent or more, this is probably not how they're formed, just because there are a few of them for which you could do it, but it's not the typical thing you find. Oh, and I'm sorry, this isn't. These big symbols here, they actually correspond to actual atmospheric to core mass ratios and core masses calculated by Lopez and Fortney. So these are actual planetary systems from Kepler for which we do have, mostly Kepler, for which we do have a measurement of the atmosphere to core mass ratio. So there may be a way out, if they really formed this way, then I think they must have gotten their envelopes from accreting from a residual gas disk that was left over at the end of giant impacts. So first of all, why do you expect there any gas to be left? Well, so giant impacts will set in once the gas disk has depleted such that you have roughly comparable amount of gas as you have in the protoplanets. And so what you assumed here is that you still have exactly that amount and that the giant impacts have already finished. And then you can ask the question, how much of this residual gas disk can be accreted? This one is slightly more tricky, and I would say this is one case where the devil is in the details, because now it does depend on a lot of assumptions that you make. So what I'm showing you here is the atmospheric masses to core mass ratio that you can get by accreting from this residual gas disk. And if you assume that there's no accretion luminosity, then you can accrete a few percent, maybe 10%, as total gas fraction. If, however, you assume that because of the giant impacts, it's not clear that your luminosity over this time scale is truly zero, because the giant impacts themselves, you need to release that gravitational energy from doubling your mass somehow, eventually. And so it just depends on what time scale that energy is released. So if it is released on the time scale over which the disk goes around, which is a million years, then you end up with this lower curve. So it's likely that the truth is probably somewhere in between those two. However, it's very hard to, at least we haven't been able to convince ourselves exactly where you will fall. And I hope that maybe somebody in this community will be able to answer this question of how quickly you would release this energy and whether it's something to worry about here. So I think if you need to explain atmospheres that are, you know, a 1% or a few percent, I think this is a viable way that they can be accreted, provided that you really had only a very small contribution from the luminosity, from the accretion luminosity during that time. Getting atmospheres that are above several percent, I'm actually very skeptical about it. I think it's challenging. It's challenging for the following reasons. So you can get, you know, maybe 10%, maybe slightly more from this late accretion. But the challenges that I see is that you do need some buffer, because we have heard both from Jonathan Fortney and from Adam, I'm blanking out on your name, I'm sorry, from Adam Burris, that we should think about photoaberration, and there's strong evidence that photoaberration sculpted these systems. And so you'd expect actually between 2 and 5 times of the envelope being lost. So ideally, I need to form things that have atmospheric masses that are 2 to 5 times more massive than what we see today. And so that's one of my worries, and that's why I'm okay with forming a few percent, because I can say I can do 10% and I can lose a factor of 5, I still get a few. But forming many of these systems for which Lopez and Fortney have calculated for us the atmospheric to core mass ratios, I think fall too far below. The other thing that I am concerned about is this drift problem. These are the drift time scales for the planetary cores, these isolation masses in the full disks. And because they are so short, the only way I can see around this problem is to by enhancing the solids relative to the gas by at least a factor of 10. Then I would have less gas. My only worry is if I do that, that I would also probably increase the opacities in my disk and in my envelope, and that would make this accretion even harder. So these are my take-home points. Maybe I'll just leave them up so I'm not taking up more time. Thank you very much.
Very nice. Questions, Becky?
I realized from the talk that I've heard about three different limits on how big a core can form from a certain surface density. And since they maybe all agree with the n-body simulations, maybe they're secretly the same thing and you can reconcile them. So I'll say what they are and maybe you can tell me if they're secretly the same. So one would be that if you're spaced apart too far, the eccentricity that you would need for your orbits to cross would give you a collision that would not be accretional. The next one would be what I talked about, where as you merge, your semi-major axis separation grows more than your hill separation, so the time scale for the next orbit crossing gets longer and longer. Then the third is the one that you talked about, where at some point your collisional cross-section becomes a big fraction of the stirring cross-section. So do you think they're fundamentally all the same, or do they maybe just apply in different regimes? Is there any way to reconcile them?
I think the first two you talked about, let me make sure. So the first one, so if you start them out too farly spaced, you may never be able to excite the eccentricity sufficiently. But I think what we have evidence, at least for doing the embodied simulations in the solar system, so if you calculate yourself consistently, if you know you want to form this kind of planet, and if you do populate your disk continuously with small enough bodies, you will actually reach that spacing of rough, which is dictated by the escape velocity. And I don't think there will be a long delay. I mean, we know actually for the terrestrial planets, there cannot have been a long delay in the set of when you assemble things by giant impacts, because the back of the envelope calculation that you would do to calculate the assembly time, assuming that they can cross and merge, is about you know, 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 years, and so you cannot have a long delay or make this inefficient, because otherwise you could not form the terrestrial planets in the time scale that we have. But if you would start your in-body simulations, and if you sparse things too sparely, I mean, with large enough separations, yes, you may never be able to get to the full limit where you can get large enough eccentricities that you can accrete over the whole of the whole extent of your of the region that will be dictated by your escape velocity. So I think it depends on the initial conditions of your simulations if you only do the in-body simulation. So I think you probably would want to start, if you started with smaller bodies, more densely spaced, you would probably get back that limit.
Other questions there? So how would your arguments change if instead of a local stirring, you assumed eccentricity excitation at resonances so that you could get a bit more non-local interaction?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I thought about this quite a bit. So first I thought maybe I can stick in like a giant planet a bit further away and it'll steer me up and you can do much better. But the thing is that you are so close that it's very hard to get significant secular excitation. You're not at 1 AU. You are like at 0.1 or inside that. You really need some like super Jupiter at 1 AU to do that for you. And we already know that there are not many Jupiters sitting at 1 AU doing that steering. If you have... Yeah. So if you have resonant chains, you can do a little better. And I guess Sean kind of showed that, I think. So instead of having four planets, you can, you know, get rid of one or two and merge them into two or three. So, and that would be typically a later assembly, because as long as, well, it would happen also, as you're saying, as the gas will go away. So you can do better by a factor of a few, I think. Yeah, because what would happen is the system is critically stable. You'll merge, but once you merged once, it's probably enough to settle down back to a stable state. So I'll give you a factor of two.
Okay, other questions? Jack.
I just want to address some of Becky's comments. And the way I look at it is you have the shear dominated local limit, which is the isolation mass. That's how I defined it when I originally came up with the idea. But that's something where you just accrete small bodies, and when things stay on low velocity dispersion, and the limit to how much material can be absorbed or accreted by a planet is due to the Kepler shear compete, which grows as you get farther away from the orbit of the planet, against the gravity of the planet, which decreases with distance. Now, if you have a lot of stirring, as the models of Viktor Safronov developed back in the 50s and 60s, then you get velocities up to around the escape velocity of the bodies, as Hilke was discussing, and that gives you another limit which is comparable to the sizes of the separations of the terrestrial planets in our own solar system. But as you mentioned, when you have these non-local effects, either perturbations from bigger bodies or material coming in, then the concepts become much fuzzier and you have a lot more freedom in the range of results you can get.
Yeah, and so this is purely to show that the extreme member of having in-situ formation without any drift is probably not what happened. So as soon as, I think it really just strongly argues that you really need to account for drift and or migration, depending on what flavor you like, because otherwise the limits are very extreme. And I think almost impossible to seriously think that there was no radial drift or migration. We know that gas affects the, we know very basic physics of how gas, especially gas drag, affects the bodies and the disks. So.
Looks like Sean won't be using his helmet today. Any other questions? None, okay. We can go to an organizing, Burkhardt. Ready for a coffee break.
Okay. Jeff, would you join me up here? Yes, so we come to the most important part of this morning's session, and that's our poster prize. So let me say how we proceeded. I asked about 8 other members and 4 organizers, and each had 2 votes, and I collected them all. And the prize, not surprisingly, goes to a person in Berkeley. Since I'm also from Berkeley, I need to stress that that person would also have won without the Berkeley votes. So Eve Lee, please come forward. Thank you. That was wonderful.
I made a clock for you. I didn't have time to show it.